Connect the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea. Tall, with wavy hair and a beautiful beard. And I'm,
he's not that tall.
Not that tall. And well, that's easy for you to say. You're taller than everybody else in the world. But yeah. So anyway, we're we're here on this fine Tuesday afternoon. It cooled off here in Washington for a couple of days, but now the sun is back. My big plan after I'm done doing this radio show is to take my copy of On the Razor's Edge by Michael Flynn. And yes, I will go for a walk in the woods and read it, because that's the kind of, yes, it's the kind of
book reading thing experience that thing you should be doing.
I was going to compare myself to Henry David Thoreau, but you threw me off.
I tried to. I'm trying to make sure that you're... I try to keep you on your toes. That's my job here.
Okay. You know, the massive men are filled with quiet desperation. That's the only thing that people know that Thoreau ever said. But anyway, so we're here today. It's a bit of a special occasion. Our Tuesday co-host has been, since the inception of the show... has been Mr. Tom McDonald.
Hey-o!
Chicken farmer, writer, all-around swell guy, America's...
McMahon impersonator.
Yes!
The Ed to your Johnny.
Yes, America's tallest Catholic radio co-host. And Tom's going to be heading off to greener pastures, doing exciting, new, and wonderful things. And so we're making an official... baton pass today from Tom.
Do a baton twirl.
You could do the twirl if you like. So we're passing the baton now. Tom is passing the baton. You may now hand the baton.
I now gift the Tuesday nights to Michael Litchens.
Michael Litchens.
You can rhymes with kitchens.
Of the baton being passed. Michael Litchens is the editor for Catholic Exchange and an all-around swell guy, another large beardy guy. Not unlike
Catholics make these things.
Me and Tom. And so everybody welcome Michael Litchens, my once and future Tuesday co-host. And everybody, thanks to Tom McDonald. I figured we'd just take... take the hour and yak about what's going on out there in the wide world. I've been distracted a bit,
really,
from what's been going on out in the wide world. There's been a spot of bother. We won't go into it, but
spot of bother.
But I like that phrase. It's a very P.G. Woodhouse. And by the way. Let me just put in a plug, because I don't think we've ever really talked about the greatness and genius of the unbelievably funny P.G. Woodhouse.
The oh my goodness! Comic mind of our generation, yes. Of the last century.
Just
I have a hilarious Hilaire Belloc story related to that.
Oh, really? Hit me. You. I'm ready.
Okay. At one point early on, sometime in the early 20th century, Belloc made his famous comment that, to the effect that Woodhouse was the greatest writer in the English language. Okay. Uh-huh. And P.G. Woodhouse ran into a then popular, now forgotten writer named Hugh Walpole. And Walpole mentioned this comment to Woodhouse, and he was very puzzled by it. And he kept saying to Woodhouse, why do you think he said that? And Woodhouse said, I have no idea why he said that. He says, really? Can you imagine why he would say such a thing about you? And Woodhouse like, no, he must be going soft in the head. And Walpole said, yes, that must be the reason he said that. And Woodhouse repeats all this in one of his books. But I just thought it was hilarious that, you could imagine if you ever read a lot of the extra little bits of P.G. Woodhouse, like his America biography, America, mm-hmm. I Love You, or I'm Not George Washington, I think it's called now, mm-hmm. and his letters and some of the biographical stuff. He was that guy. He wasn't this bitter man turning out funny stuff. Uh-huh. he was P.G. Woodhouse, you will be pleased to know, was really P.G. Woodhouse. He was really an amiably charming, funny, self-deprecating, mystery-loving guy.
It's true. Somebody once said, he wrote, for those who are not familiar with him, you can start Gully. He was as prolific as Augustine. He's just amazing. He cranked out gazillions of stories, and they're all like elaborately plotted farces and this sort of thing. And somebody once asked him, you know, what's your method? How do you do this? And his reply was, well, I just sit at the typewriter and curse a bit. And
he called it musical theater. He called it musical comedy without the music. And a lot of people don't realize he wrote the book for Anything Goes. He was a collaborator with some of the great songwriters of that time, and he wrote a lot of lyrics.
Yeah.
You know, and when you look at it, and the thing is, if you want to get into Woodhouse, you got to go on the internet and get your title straightened out, because American and British releases have different titles for the same book. And the problem with this is the plot is pretty much always the same plot. Someone's trying to marry Bertie or something, and Bertie has to get out in Jeeves. It's like a Gilligan's Island kind of thing. You know, it's the variations, though. So get your title straight. And the other thing I'd recommend is to check out Audible if you have an Audible subscription, or because he's great to hear narrated. Jonathan Cecil is a great narrator that's on Audible right now. And my daughter goes to bed with him every night. It's why they have a weird manner of speech. She said something the other day. I can't even remember what it was. It wasn't Dash at all, Aunt Agatha, but it was something along those lines. I said something, and she replied, quite. And, you know,
quite.
Quite. Quite. And I said, really? You realize that there's no other 15-year-old in your public high school that says quite.
Still have my childhood. My mom raised me on BBC murder mysteries because that was her favorite thing. So I grew up watching, you know, Perrault and all those guys. And I actually, well, growing up in rural Oregon, it just meant everyone thought I was gay. So whatever.
Just one more reason to grow a beard. I mean, golly, you really can't get to the end of it. The thing about Woodhouse, this is something that C.S. Lewis observed, is that there are some writers who have a genius for coming up with stories that he says that are like it's in the context of an essay that he's writing on myth. And he's talking about what's the distinction between myth and other kinds of stories. And he says, he argues that a myth is something that has a deeply satisfying shape, like a vase. Right. And really, as long as you have the shape right, it really doesn't matter how you decorate it or what you put into the vase. Right. It just, the shape is what matters. And he says, so there are some stories that really anybody can tell, as long as you know as long as you get the outline of the myth right, as long as you get the shape right, your prose style doesn't matter. And so he says, he talks about, he's thinking in particular of George MacDonald, who he regards as one of the greatest myth makers of all time.
Sure.
And he says as a prose stylist, he says, George MacDonald was kind of a fourth-rate prose stylist, but as a myth maker, nobody was his equal. And in comparison to that, he talks about people like Dickens, or supremely P.G. Woodhouse.
Right.
P.G. Woodhouse is somebody that everything is about the way he phrases things. He is just so incredibly funny. I remember him. He just uses these turns of phrase that just kill you.
Oh yeah.
And the amazing thing about Woodhouse is that in his entire long life of productivity and writing some of the funniest English prose ever written, not one single story he ever told has any deep meaning to it at all. I've heard it described, it's like eating a gigantic bowl of whipped cream. And, you know, sometimes a great big old honking bowl of whipped cream is just what you want.
That's right. I mean, it's really a good mental a mental soothing thing. I mean, I go to sleep to them at night because, first of all, I know them all, and I don't need to know them all because, like I said, they're all very familiar stories. But they are—they soothe the soul, and we don't have quite enough of that in our world today.
Yeah,
and you have to take a moment to put some major, major props out to Fry and Laurie for their four seasons.
Oh, yes. Oh,
yeah,
I'm watching some of them again with my daughter, and there was in the third season they got a woman finally playing Madeline Bassett that is absolutely, if you're talking about Vesa, she is a work of art. The third season Madeline Bassett has a voice that you could not in your wildest dreams have imagined, and I don't know how she did it. She has like a squeak and a hiccup she does, and it is poetry in motion.
Oh yeah,
this series.
Yeah, I love Madeline. Madeline Bassett is the woman who's pursuing Bertie Wooster, who thinks the stars are God's daisy chain.
That's right.
Just so great. Well, you're listening to Connecting the Dots. We'll be back right after this. We're here today with Tom McDonald and Michael Litchens, and we'll be back in just a jiffy.
You're listening to Breadbox Media. Find out more at breadboxmedia.com.
Hey there. Hi there. Ho there. You're as welcome as can be. Back to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea. And we're here today with Tom McDonald and Mr. Michael Litchens. We're having a jolly time here. We're talking about P.G. Wodehouse. Now, you may be asking, what does P.G. Wodehouse have to do with the Catholic faith? And that is a great question. And you should keep asking questions like that a lot. yes. Actually, well, there is a bit of a connection because speaking of Belloc, when Chesterton died, someone remarked, I forget who, that P.G. Wodehouse is now the greatest English prose stylist still alive. That was in 1936. Mm-hmm. P.G. Wodehouse like lived forever. He died in 1974 at the age of like 94,
yeah,
or something. And I remember seeing some book that he published in like 1930. And it was like his 50th book in 1930. And his introduction is like, 50? You know, that's rather a damned lot. I that's at least something, isn't it? You know? And but he was just so funny. I found a poem. It was a favorite poem of his that was written, I don't even know when. He wrote a lot of funny poetry, too. It's called Printer's Error. So it begins, as o'er my latest book I pored, enjoying it immensely, I suddenly exclaimed, good Lord, and gripped the volume tensely. Golly, I cried. I writhed in pain. They've done it on me once again. And furrows creased my brow. I'd written, which I thought quite good, Ruth, ripening into womanhood, was now a girl who knocked men flat and frequently got whistled at. And some vile, careless, casual gook had spoiled the best thing in the book by printing not, yes, not, Great Scott, when I had written now. On murder in the first degree, the law, I knew, is rigid. Its attitude, if A kills B, to A is always frigid. It counts it not a trivial slip if on behalf of ownership, of authorship, you liquidate compositors. This kind of conduct it abhors. Something's thumping back there. This kind of conduct it abhors and seldom will allow. Nevertheless, I deemed it best and in the public interest to buy a gun, to oil it well, inserting what is called a shell, and go and pot with sudden shot the printer who had printed not when I had written now. I tracked the bounder to his den through private information. I said good afternoon and then explained the situation. I'm not a fussy man, I said. I smile when you put rid for red and bad for bed and hoed for head and bulge instead of bow. When wone appears in lieu of wine or if you alter cone to shine, I never make a row. I know how easy errors are, but this time you have gone too far by printing not when you knew what I really wrote was now. Prepare, I said, to meet your god, or as you'd say, your goo or bot, possibly your gal. A few weeks later, into court, I came to stand my trial. The judge was quite a decent sort. He said, well, cocky, I'll be passing sentence in a jiff. And so, my poor unhappy stiff, if you have anything to say, now is the moment. Fire away. You have. I said, and how, me lord? The facts I don't dispute. I did, I own it, freely shoot this printer through the collar stud. Who else, what else could I have done, my lord? He printed not. The judge said, what? When you had written now? God bless my soul. Gadzook, said he. The blighters did that once to me. A dirty trick, I trow. I hereby quash and override the jury's verdict. Gosh, he cried. Give me your hand. Yes, I insist. You splendid fellow. Case dismissed. Cheers and a voice. Wow, wow. A statue stands against the sky, lifelike and rather pretty. Twas recently erected by the PEN committee, and many a passerby is stirred, for on the plinth, if that's the word, in golden letters you may read, this is the man who did the deed. His hand set to the plow, he did not sheath the sword, but got a gun at great expense and shot the human blot who'd printed not when he had written now. He acted with no thought of self, not for advancement, not for pelf, but just because it made him hot to think the man had printed not when he had written now. So, there you go. Prepare to meet your goo or bod. Possibly your gal. I love that so much. Yes. Oh.
So, he's a fantastic one. I can always appreciate the wit.
Yeah, just fantastic. Yeah, if you are out there in Radioland of you and you've never seen the really quite good adaptations of some of his Jeeves and Wooster stories by Fry and Laurie, Stephen Fry and Hugh Laurie. They're really worth seeing. Hugh Laurie was really born to play Bertie Wooster.
He really was. Like the moment he gets on there, all you could think about is like, wow, he was born for this. And I'm kind of wondering, like, I almost want to hear him say, well, I don't mind. I admit it. I'm a chump. My Aunt Agatha would testify to this effect.
Yeah, he's great. And I got to say, Stephen Fry is very good as Jeeves, too. He's just so droll. Yes. So P.G. Wodehouse, if you've never read him, you really should. You will not be in the slightest. It won't raise your intellect in any particular way. You will not come away from it with deep spiritual insights. But you know,
thank God, right?
Not everything has to be Shakespeare. You know, I mean,
thankfully.
Yeah, it's just it really is. It's just he is. If you're looking for some really great whipped cream, T.G. Wodehouse makes the best whipped cream I think ever made. Yeah.
It is one of the best lines of prose you will find. It really is, you know, set aside plot and everything else and meaning, it is just the English language at its most perfect.
I think.
Because it's musical and funny and it can shift kind of tones into, you know, absurdity and farce and satire and all kinds of things very subtly, but it is just a great. If you wrote like P.G. Wodehouse, just in terms of his line, we're not even talking his humor, his plots or anything, just in terms of the line itself, you would be a brilliant writer.
Yeah. Oh, hands down.
And you know, probably the closest thing that you could find in Wodehouse to Wodehouse being serious, and it's still like here to Alpha Centauri, not all that close, is his character Roderick Spode. He creates this magnificent character named Roderick Spode, who was a direct this was Woodhouse's commentary on the rise of British fascism, particularly Sir Oswald Mosley, who was this guy who, you know, as only the British could do, they produced a fascist who was just hilarious. And Roderick Spode is very clearly modeled on Oswald Mosley. And Roderick Spode, he starts this, he's this huge bully who's always threatening to beat Bertie Wooster to a jelly. Yes. To a jelly. And he starts up this organization called the Black Shorts, and that's their thing. they wear black shorts and they march around, and he gives these bombastic speeches, and his speeches are so great because he's got this thing about the British knee. Yes. The British knee is firm. The British knee is muscular. The British knee is on the march. And and it was, he is so funny. And that was kind of how it was, the extremely British way that the Woodhouse dealt with this thing that was going on in his country at the time. He's writing in the 30s when he creates Roderick Spode. Yeah. And, Roderick Spode is just fantastically funny. And then it turns out that you finally discover Jeeves, who is sort of like this... he's a manservant, but he's like part manservant, part guardian angel, you know?
More or less.
And part, fairy godmother. He just solves all of Bertie's problems at the end of every story. But anyway, he tells Bertie to... when Roderick is threatening him, just tell him, I know all about Eulalie.
Yes.
And Spode just like melts into this docile kitten when this happens. It's like super mysterious. Why does he do this? And it turns out that he works for some like ladies' underwear shop, and this is like his darkest secret. because he wants to be all man, and he's just humiliated by this fact that he works for a ladies' underwear shop, and just magnificent, magnificent show.
Yes.
So and books. So P.G. Woodhouse, there you go. And we're running out of time for this segment.
Okay.
But we'll be back right after this. You're listening to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea. We're here today with Tom McDonald and Mr. Michael Litchens. We'll be back right now.
Redbox Media now is a great way for you to go deeper with your favorite show or shows in our programming lineup. With our Friend of the Show opportunity, you get extra exclusive content from your favorite show hosts and lots of extra love from the shows and hosts you love. Become a friend of the show by clicking on the link on our website or app menu. Your $10 monthly premium membership will unlock an exclusive world just for you. Support your favorite show today as a friend of the show. Friend of the Show premium memberships exclusively for you with Redbox Media.
Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we are here today with Mr. Tom McDonald, erstwhile nearly former Tuesday co-host, of Catholic and Enjoy It, and Michael Litchin's new hotness.
Phase four complete.
Tuesday co-hosts.
I'm the old model.
Tom it's McDonald, like old and busted.
That's right.
Michael Litchin's new hotness.
It's like all right, Donald we got Trump. Tom he trades up to a new wife every, what, yeah, 4 or 5 years.
And we're going to take Tom over to a pharma in upstate New York. We'll have plenty of room to run and play. You know, it's going to be fine.
That's right. No, I actually had a dog that went up.
Your parents
no, really, my parents son. Took him up there. He lived out of...
He'll be spending the sunset years of his life there, just
reading obscure stories.
That's it. So, you were telling a story over the break. I think it's worth hearing or worth
continue on this light mood with Woodhouse.
Yes, we're.
I think we should end
talking
this.
About light.
And this, by the way, I disappeared for a little while there. I want you to know we've been doing shows together for, what, 2 years, I guess, back since Ave Maria. Was that where we were for? And for the first time ever, I'm getting old. I stepped on my power switch.
Shut yourself off.
I stepped on the, you know, surge protector switch under the desk, and I'm like, okay. I am now officially my mother. No, so the story, yes. So among my little obsessions, I'm just a person of many micro obsessions. Nothing. This is why I have the career I have, because I never did anything terribly seriously. And one of them is Sherlockian stuff. I've done a little bit of writing on it. And if you know the Sherlockian game with Sherlock Holmes is treating the stories as if they're real and trying to square the errors in them. Now, there was a great pulp writer who I had the great gift to meet once named Manly Wade Wellman. And he was one of the giants of the pulp era. Mm-hmm. He wrote a great series about a fantasy series about a folk singer with like a magic guitar kind of thing. It's just, he was just one of the greats. And he wrote an early Sherlockian influential essay proving that Jeeves was the illegitimate child of Irene Adler and Sherlock Holmes, which was, it seemed completely natural when you think of Jeeves's intellect, because you know, Bertie's always saying that Jeeves is very smart because, you know, he eats a lot of fish, you know, that's real brain food, but it's actually his genes. And on another Catholic note, since we are a Catholic show, we should probably bring it around there. The whole idea of this Sherlockian game, treating the canon as if they were there was a Dr. Watson writing real documentary stories about a real Sherlock Holmes. This was cooked up, initiated by a Catholic priest, so like so many great things. Father Ronald Knox, one of the great Catholic figures of the 20th century.
Yeah, who was himself. He wrote a couple of really great works of theology. He did a piece called The Mass in Slow Motion, a bit outdated now because that mass is not commonly said, but he also did a fantastic book called Enthusiasm.
I don't know that one, actually.
Oh,
I read a lot of Ronald Knox. That's a new one.
Oh, you should read Enthusiasm. It's great. It's basically this look at the history of exactly that, enthusiastic movements in the church, you know, from Montanism, for example, and various other movements, including he also looks at, you know, some of the crazier, like 17th century Protestant movements. And just looks at how this dynamic plays out over and over in the life of the church. Somebody has some, and also movements that dodge that bullet, like Franciscanism. Some Franciscans spun off into space, but Franciscanism managed to stay within the pale of the church.
Yes.
Anyway, fascinating book. But he was also he combined this passion for writing about theology, he was a Catholic convert. But also loved murder mysteries.
Mm-hmm.
So he was one of the founders, along with Dorothy Sayers and G.K. Chesterton and Agatha Christie and various others, of the Detection Club.
Right.
Yes.
Which Sayers described as basically they just went to restaurants and ate good food and talked endless shop.
Right. Well, they did a round robin novel too, called The Floating Admiral, the Detective Club with, they might have done two. One of them has, The Floating Admiral is the one with the chapter by Chesterton.
Yes.
But it's like Agatha Christie, Dorothy Sayers, G.K. Chesterton, Ronald Knox. I mean, all of these people, and like a bunch of guys I don't remember, all wrote a chapter. You know, of this book, and it's just a hot mess.
Yeah,
it's great,
but super fun.
You know,
there is, by the way, just inserting this here. You could probably still find it, like in maybe some used book place, maybe on Amazon. There's a book that came out, 20 years or so ago now, called Carnage at Christhaven. Hmm. It was a similar kind of round robin, and it was all written by these various Christian writers.
Oh, really?
And it was just side-splitting. It was so funny. Carnage at Christhaven, really, really funny.
Well, the funny thing about Knox is he wanted his tombstone. I don't know if he got this. I just remember reading this. He used to joke that he wanted his tombstone to say author of The Bible and the Viaduct Murders. Because he had translated the Knox Bible as the new version translated. Now, I have a very handsome edition of it here, and I've read pieces of it, and I like Ronald Knox. The book I read from his a lot is a very thick one called Pastoral and Occasional Sermons that's just easy to dip into. But I'm not a huge fan of the Knox Bible, actually.
Okay.
But it is a very different approach, and it's very much an Anglo-Saxon approach. He wrote the book itself when it was republished in a leather-bound edition recently, a couple years ago, came with a chapbook of his essay on Englishing the Bible, is what the essay was. And it was very interesting on his thought processes on going through the whole thing and creating a new translation. Mm-hmm. I keep taking cracks at it once in a while, trying to find, because I do admire his prose style, but I guess I'm used to my RSV too much.
Yeah.
You know, but
yeah, well, it was interesting. Well, there's a quite remarkable movement of, you know, some really pretty high powered literary types in the early 20th century who take a huge interest in trying to present the biblical narrative to a popular audience in a new way.
Right.
So you get the Knox Bible, and you also get a whole something which was revolutionary at the time. You get a whole series of radio dramas written by Dorothy Sayers,
right?
Which are just basically retelling of the gospel.
Evil and Waugh, you know, he considered his greatest work. This isn't necessarily biblical, but he wrote a book about St. Monica, and was it St. Monica or St. Helena? St. Helena. And and the one that I liked was his biography. Oh my gosh, Campion.
Yeah, Edmund Campion. That's a great biography.
His book on Campion. Yeah. And funnily enough, Waugh was Knox's executor. Literary executor. Evelyn Waugh was Knox's friend.
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Well, there was, because there was this, like, you know, movement between the wars, especially, of all these, you know, high-powered literary converts or people who were very strongly empathetic to, you know, a deeply Catholic worldview. So you have people like Sayers, who remains an Anglican, but she adored Chesterton.
You look at those people, Sayers and T.S. Eliot are the people who come to mind. These were Anglo-Catholics that, and perhaps Lewis to a lesser degree, who would have crossed the Tiber. And Evelyn Underhill, the mystical writer, who very underrated, not read by Catholics generally, but should be. She wrote the great book Mystics. These are people who, for one reason or another, couldn't get past their limitations or their biases or whatever to become Catholic, but loved everything else Catholic.
Right.
You know, and that's what irritated Tolkien so much with Lewis, was he felt she would have been a Catholic if he didn't have that his damnable Northern Irish prejudice.
Right.
Right.
Yeah.
And I think the same can be said of Eliot and Sayers to some degree, that they just couldn't do it.
Yeah. Yeah, and that was an issue. You know, Chesterton, I think part of the thing with Chesterton is that Chesterton was far less class conscious. Right. And he makes that very, I mean, Chesterton's just kind of a slob, you know? Right. And, you know, he's a Fleet Street journalist. And so he's more comfortable crossing class lines than other people were. And that was a big deal in England. You're listening to Connecting the Dots. I'm here today with Mr. Tom McDonald, Mr. Michael Hitchens. We've been talking a bit about favorite writers, and we'll be back on Connecting the Dots right after this.
Thank you for listening to Breadbox Media Podcasts. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app. Change the world.
Coming to Connecting the Dots. that's it for German for me. Although I do know how to say "Mein Onkel ist krank, aber die Autobahn ist grün." So there's that, which means my uncle is sick, but the highway is green.
I actually understand.
You actually knew that. Okay, good. So,
is that from something? I mean, I know enough German
actually,
to kind of.
It really is. Okay, this is really, really obscure. So when I was a kid, my brother had a big collection of Mad magazines. I was a huge Mad magazine fan.
Still am.
And yeah. And one of their articles, one time in some issue back in the mid-60s, was about a game called 43 Man Squamish.
Sounds promising. About.
Know what I'm talking about.
I used to sit in my uncle's garage and read those.
Okay. 43 Man Squamish. And so at some point in the game of 43 Man Squamish, the referee is supposed to, you know, throw the wiffle ball into the thing or whatever. I forget what
it was. Ridiculous.
It was ridiculous and elaborate. But as he did so, he was supposed to announce the onset of play with the ritual cry, "Mein Onkel ist krank, aber die Autobahn ist grün." And I never forgot that. So it was just like, okay.
That's hilarious.
I used to know how to say that in like multiple languages because it just it was just a thing for me. So
see, wow. I get all those collections that come out because the kids love them, and so they're all very well versed in Mad. So you know, I get the reprints when I can, and that was a really old one. If I'm remembering correctly, that was, you know, right closer to the beginning in the Kurtzman era of Mad. So do you remember?
Yeah. So anyway, I was going to mention, speaking of Knoxes, in addition to Monsignor Ronald Knox, I've been to the grave of another famous Knox, John Knox. A lot of people may not remember John Knox, especially people in our audience may not be altogether familiar with John Knox. John Knox was basically the father of Scottish Presbyterianism. And he is the author of perhaps, and there's a lot of choices here, but this is ranks right up at the top of my favorite Reformation era, unbelievably over the top religious tract. The Reformation was the original flame war that was conducted. You know, there was no internet, but there was this brand new piece of awesome technology called the printing press, and people just went nuts with it. And so the whole Reformation was conducted before it was conducted with swords and pikes and longbows. Before that, it was conducted with warring tracts between Protestants and Catholics. And talk about lack of editorial constraint. These guys, they wrote. So there's
I can't
there's,
even quote like Thomas More from that era on Catholic radio. It's that interesting.
It's rude. Yeah, it's amazing stuff. And just, you know, it's all about, you know, and it's full of, you know, these religious polemics, but also like full of like fart jokes and, you know, all this kind of stuff. Right? You just can't even believe it. And so the Protestants seem to have a real knack for this, because the ones that really stick out in my mind are things like 200 great fat well-swilled papistical lies. And that's like just the title, right? And then you get into the tract and it's just this unhinged rant. But Knox was the author. Just a little refresher course on the course of English history. So Henry VIII wins the title of Defender of the Faith in one of the most premature accolades ever given. And because he wrote a defense of the seven sacraments that really he didn't write. The guy who actually wrote it was Thomas More.
Thomas More.
And anyway, he gets the title of Defender of the Faith, and then he has trouble having a son with his first wife. So he says, that marriage didn't count. I really want to marry Anne Boleyn. And so he manages to get himself another wife. And the Pope is less and less happy with his marital adventures. The real problem, of course, nobody understands gynecology in those days. It has to be the woman's fault that I can't have a kid. And so that doesn't work out for various reasons. And so he breaks with Rome and says, you know what? I'm the head of the church in England, not some foreign pope.
Yes.
And at that point, Thomas More quietly steps down from his role as chancellor. And this is a big blow for Henry, because although More doesn't say anything, everybody assumes that the reason he's resigned is because he cannot countenance this, which is perfectly true, but More knows that he's protected by his silence. Silence implies consent under English law, and so without him saying anything, legally, the way the law has to be construed is that he supports Henry, even though he hasn't said anything. But Henry can't stick with that, so eventually Henry has More killed, and you can see all about that in A Man for All Seasons. And then Henry gets old and gets sick and dies, and he's got a kid who quickly dies, who's syphilitic. And then Mary, Queen of England, takes over, and she says, you know what? We should never have broken with the Catholic Church. And so she tries to go back and make England a Catholic nation. Well, by this time, Scottish Presbyterianism has taken off, thanks to John Knox. And John Knox lives in Edinburgh, and his pulpit is in St. Giles Church, which is just down the hill from Edinburgh Castle. I mean, and I've walked that little space. And so John Knox writes a pamphlet in which he expresses his mild disapproval of Mary re-Catholicizing England, with the unforgettable title, A First Blast of the Trumpet Against the Monstrous Regiment of Women in the Land. And so eventually she cacks, and then Elizabeth takes over, and Elizabeth says, yeah, actually we are Protestant, and let's start beating up all the Catholics. And so we're off on to the rest of the history of Protestantized England. But A First Blast of the Trumpet Against the Monstrous Regiment of Women, it remains one of my favorite over-the-top Reformation-era titles. And anyway, Knox eventually dies as well, and I have visited his grave. And his grave is right there in the churchyard of St. Giles Parish. The thing is the churchyard is no longer there because they had to put in a parking lot. So they put in a parking lot, and you can go to parking space 23. I'm not making this up. You go to parking space 23 in the parking lot next to St. Giles Church, and there's a little plaque that's sunk into the asphalt that says, "We're pretty sure this is about where John Knox is buried." So
parking space 23.
Well, the thing is, partly this has to do with Puritan theology, actually. And you can see the same thing reflected in graves in Boston, right in the middle of downtown Boston. So the idea of Puritan graves was, you know, you throw somebody in the dirt bed, you bury them, and then you dig the next grave, and so on and so forth, and you just keep, you know, row after row after row until you fill up the cemetery. And then, by that time, the guy in space number one is probably pretty much one with the earth. So you just dig that grave up, and you just plant somebody else there. And so every grave contains, like, multiple occupants. Because there was
Act 5, Scene 1 of Hamlet.
Right. Exactly.
There was no particular reverence for the body in Puritan theology because, you know, what matters is the spirit and so on and so forth. So anyway, me being a papist, I went to parking lot 23 and, you know, said a prayer for poor John Knox's gray soul and went off. And but yeah, so John Knox, parking lot. Space number 23 at St. Giles Parish Church.
I greatly prefer Ronald Knox.
Yes, we all do.
I prefer a guy who could preach a heck of a sermon on Sunday, write a murder mystery on Monday, and translate the Bible from the Hebrew and Greek on Tuesday. You know, and hang out with Evil and Waugh Wednesday night.
Yeah,
I mean, that's true. A guy. You know, that was a priest who, you know, knew all these people, worked with them. You know.
Yeah,
and wrote a fine line of prose.
Yeah, he was a badass. I got to say, he was pretty impressive. So, yeah. Oh well, golly, looks like we're just about out of time here. But Tom McDonald, we'll meet again. don't know when, but I know we'll meet again some sunny day. So,
how about in October? If I go to Jordan, I'll try to do a remote for you.
That would be fun. Oh yeah, let's do that. That would be so great. Let's do it then. So. All right. Well, I want to thank you so much for being on the show this past year and a half, year and 8 months, and I want to welcome Michael Litchens, and we will see you next week, Michael.
Sounds good. I'll look forward to it, Mark.